men and women experience little bowel leaks equally. I think that in the next couple of years, there's going to be increasing awareness of just how large a problem it is.
No one knows how to build products consumers need like those from the consumer products industry. Entrepreneur Kelly Brzozowski is bringing her expertise to a healthcare need and tackling the unmentionables of aging in the process.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health. I'm David Shaywitz.
And I'm Lisa Soonan.
Now I am presenting you with this.
$20 million at $100 million valuation? This is way more than any other offer.
Correct.
So, David, have you seen this TV show, Silicon Valley?
Watching every episode. I'm living it, baby.
It's so crazy. It's like a freaking documentary, don't you think?
Totally.
I loved this week's episode about unicorns, or at least the concept of entrepreneurs taking lots of money at crazy high valuations.
And we're seeing a huge number of high valuations these days in the Valley.
Don't take this deal.
What?
You are worth half that, at best.
Oh, wow. Thanks for the compliment.
You know, credit to you guys. You negotiated your asses off, but this is a classic runaway valuation.
What's wrong with that?
Pied Piper will be tied to this crazy valuation that you will never be able to live up to. Maybe go with the lowest offer you got. Even that might be too high.
Yeah, I really loved how they talked about the risk and the downside of that for entrepreneurs.
Yeah, I don't think many people appreciate that.
Yeah, I really think it's so true. It's a cautionary tale, I think, for entrepreneurs. They get very caught up in the excitement of it, but sometimes it's probably not the best thing for them.
And just because you can raise a huge amount of money doesn't necessarily mean that it's in your best interest to do so.
Do you think that this message will get through? Will life imitate art?
Well, I hope so. I think it's a start.
And speaking of starting, I'm really excited today to have Kelly Lewis Brzozowski here with us today. Kelly's the CEO and founder of Butterfly Health, Inc., a dynamic company with big mission, helping people live better lives through attending to one of the unmentionable patient challenges that lead to poor quality of life, little bowel leaks, that keep people from doing the things they want to do. It's one of those things people don't talk about, but Kelly's used to taking those taboo subjects into the open and solving them with practical products. And she's done doing that since her time at Procter & Gamble, where she introduced leading consumer health products in the U.S. and Asia. Kelly is a real consumer health innovator and advocate who believes Butterfly is on the cusp of the next big wave in consumer products innovation, providing wellness solutions to boomers as they seek to feel well and live well in their next 30 years of life. Kelly also founded the Healthy Mature Living Foundation to further this mission. We're delighted to have you here today, Kelly. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And, you know, one of the things I admire about you, among the many, is that you're so good at getting people to talk openly about health challenges that they would normally keep secret and are ashamed of, but if treated, would make their lives a lot better. So what is it about you that lets you get past that squeamishness and right at the business of it?
I think it's really the incredible impact that it has when people bring these unmentionables out into the open. You know, there's not one person that I've ever met that hasn't felt better after they've been able to talk about their bowel leakage. And so I think really the challenge is, how do we frame these conditions and things that we all experience in ways that make it easy and accessible for people to get the help they need?
How did you wind up in this? When you were last in line
to pick a job.
Well, you know, it seems an interesting thing to wind up at. Was it from something that you were doing at Procter & Gamble? Was it something before that? Was it a lifelong interest? Was it someone you knew? How did you sort of wind up in this space?
I think I've always had a really keen interest at this intersection of where the consumer and health merge. And I had my first experience on that working on the Always brand at P&G, where working in feminine hygiene, and particularly with women that have challenges with their menstrual periods and how little things can make such a big difference. And so I had the very fortunate experience at P&G of working on lots of new products and new categories, and I really just found that that was my personal passion. So when I left P&G, I ended up landing back in Northern California and was actually doing consulting work, working with biotech companies that tended to have scientific founders, interesting technology and science, but really didn't yet have a clue about how they were going to commercialize that technology. And so One of the companies I worked with was a little company at the time called Averon that had a new nasal spray flu vaccine called Flumist and was working on Flumist back, I think, well, 8 years before it received FDA approval. And we were doing all of the work with moms and children about a new nasal spray type of flu vaccine.
Yeah, my kids love that. We call it smell the roses.
Right. No. and I think Flumist was really at the time very disruptive, right? It was a disruptive new way to deliver a vaccine. And the vision for that product and the efficacy of that product was fantastic. And so it was, how do we take this and figure out a way to get into the vaccine market with something different? At a totally different cost structure, because back at that time you could go to any drugstore and get a free flu shot, right? And so this was a biotech with a disruptive innovation that had a totally different cost structure than free shots. So one thing led to the next, and I actually had a client that was developing a product, a prescription device for something called fecal incontinence. And so I had the opportunity to get exposed to this unmet need through that particular client. They had they have a wonderful device on the prescription side, and when they decided not to commercialize that product, and I was out sort of back looking at what I was going to do next, I actually had one of my very first bosses at P&G challenge me. She said, "You know, Kelly, you're so passionate about this unmet need," and I was in the process of establishing a new foundation to develop education and resources for people who have bowel leaks, because there's 50 million of them. And she said, "Put your thinking cap on. Surely, with all the time you spend on Always, we can come up with something new." And that's really how Butterfly was born.
Well, I think, you know, it's so interesting, Kelly, because this whole concept of consumerism and healthcare, if you come at it from the medical side, from the healthcare side, it's like a new thing, right? Mm-hmm. Suddenly people have been activated as consumers. Mm-hmm. But if you come at it from the consumer product side, it's like, well, duh, you know,
yeah.
That's what people are. So, you know, it must be very interesting for you to interact with the healthcare people that you're now interacting with versus the sort of more, you know, consumer product side of the world. You know, how are you finding educating the healthcare, you know, wonky people about the true, you know, needs of healthcare consumers, about retail and about all those things?
You know, I think the younger thought leaders on the clinician and physician and healthcare side, the people coming through now, really have that shared vision, because they're seeing patients and realizing that sometimes the key, you know, to enabling living better isn't treating something acute, right? It's not sickness. It's how do you improve wellness? And so Dr. Heidi Brown out of now the University of Wisconsin is a very well-published urogynecologist who she and I have been collaborating for many years now. And I think there are people that understand that improving wellness is about making sure that patients understand what they can do and making it accessible. And your blog touched on this recently, which was really I think really important. You know, I think when you're a large pharmaceutical company, and the pharma companies know this, right? If you look at, you know, there's nothing that $200 or $300 million in advertising won't do to teach people that all of a sudden, when they have those, you know, drips and dribbles, when they cough and sneeze and laugh, is not just drips and dribbles, but something called SUI, right? Or stress urinary incontinence. So I think there's, on the pharma side, I think there's embedded an enormous amount of consumer understanding. The challenge, I think, is when you're a small company and you're starting out and you don't have that $200 or $300 million to teach the world that really, you know, fecal incontinence, it's not fecal incontinence. It's about people who have, 90% of people have little bowel leaks, right? It's like, imagine the world before Kleenex, right? You know, people were running around with runny noses and wiping their hands and their clothes, you know, on their sleeves, whatever.
My kid still does that, I think.
Yeah.
But I imagine so much of what your role must be is to try to come up with sort of analogies like that, is trying to take something that people can't really talk about and come up with a way for them to be able to express it and to talk about it mm-hmm. in a more familiar way. Is that something that you feel like you've been focusing on?
Certainly, right? And I think when you have the right solution, in our case, Butterfly actually gives people a voice. There's not one person that was ever in our trials. You know, often someone would come in, more often than not, they had never told anybody about their bowel leakage. You know, we were the first people hearing about it. they'd do a butterfly trial, they'd come back, and the first thing they wanted to tell us was the five people they told about their problem. And I think when you have a solution that frames it in a way that reduces stigma, it makes it easy for people. And so when they say, oh, I've got this thing and I've got this product and it's butterfly and it's little, right? I mean, butterfly is like a panty liner for the bum, but it takes 100%, resolves 100% of the hygiene challenges that people have with sort of a little bit of a leaky bum. You know, when they say that, it's not like they're disclosing to someone, oh, I'm buying Depends now, right? It's not like admitting I've got this big problem. And I think that the art is really how do we come up with the language and the words and the tools that allow people to reduce stigma of these conditions.
So VCs, venture capitalists, love to fund new innovations, but they hate consumer products. They hate consumer products because, like you said, it takes a couple hundred million dollars of promotion and advertising to make these new products known enough, recognizable enough to be a category killer, right?
Right.
And VCs don't like to spend $200 million much at all, but they especially don't like to spend it on advertising. So how do you bridge that gap? How do you make this palatable to the Silicon Valley innovation, you know, so-called glitterati?
I think it's tough. You know, I think we, I think there were many, many, many people who loved the idea, who understood the unmet need. But the it all comes down to source of funds and what are you going to do with those funds, right? And I think there's a general discomfort with spending dollars on the consumer in the venture space. Mm-hmm. You know, $10 million into a clinical trial.
We've preferred to waste it on other things.
Right. $10 million on a clinical trial, no problem, right? Mm-hmm. With a totally unpredictable, uncertain outcome. Mm-hmm. But, you know, talk about trying to put $10 million into a marketing program and it's a tough sell. Mm-hmm. You're right. So,
but haven't there been successes like Method?
Yes, I think, but, you know, Method took a long time, right? You know, Method was, you know, more than 10 years, I think, in the making before they eventually exited. And it took a long time. And there was a lot of spade work to get that, to get it to the place where they eventually exited.
So when you were growing up, where did you think you were going? What did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
That's a great question. You know, my parents were both incredible examples of public service. My father was in the military and my mother was a public school teacher who eventually has gone on to develop curriculum for a couple of states in the Southeast. And I thought originally that I was going to go into public service and end up in the
Absolutely,
I did.
I would say you did.
I thought I was probably going to end up at the Georgetown School of Foreign Service and end up working for the State Department someday. But I had a really interesting thing happen when I was in college and I had the opportunity to
Didn't
do...
Didn't we all? We don't talk about it.
I had the opportunity to do an internship for the governor of North Carolina, and I won't say who that was at the time when I was at Chapel Hill. And I just saw some things that kind of made me think I could probably have much greater impact if I took my passion for things I believed in and tried to do that in a commercial and business context.
What was the thing that made you think that?
You know, it really was just, there was some policy discussions going on and I was observing some meetings where it was much more horse trading of, well, if you can do this, then I can do this. And it just didn't seem like it was focused on what are the right and best interests of our constituents.
It sounds like it was very disillusioning.
It was.
But it sounds like that's, I mean, one hears in large companies that there's a fairly large political component as well. It sounds like you didn't experience that at P&G.
Not at all. I mean, and it was interesting, you know, I really remember when I made that shift. And then I had a very strong interest in consumer products marketing. You know, I had a few cottage entrepreneurial adventures when
like
I was
what?
Young.
No, tell us about it.
So,
yeah.
So
give us a story of one of them.
One of them, probably the first, was I'll never forget when I was, I think I was in sixth grade, and I spent an entire summer making these little clothespin soldiers that my grandmother taught me to make that I could sell at the Christmas fair on King Street in Old Town Alexandria. And I don't know, I think I'd made, you know, 300 or 400 of them by the time this fair, and I sold every single one of them like in the first 2 hours. So
wow. At any rate, it's only sixth grade, but still. No.
So I'd always had an interest. I designed cards, you know, graphic cards. I think there was at one point I thought, oh, maybe it would be fun to work for Hallmark. But when I decided that that's what I wanted to do, I really became very interested in having the opportunity to work at P&G. And, you know, fortunately that worked out. And
what was the first product you worked on at P&G?
Always.
Oh, really?
Always. And in the first 2 weeks of my time at P&G, they had just launched a product called Always Slender for Teens. And so it was an entry point product, which, as you know, can be very important and mature in large market segments, that you've got an entry point item.
For lifetime branding.
And bringing people in at the entry point. So I remember one of the co-founders of Butterfly, who was my very first brand manager, Elizabeth Ron, said, Kelly, we're going to send you out to these focus groups in Los Angeles. And I thought, oh gosh, you know, I've only been at P&G a few weeks and I'm getting to fly to LA. And I grew up in Southern California, so it was all good, right? And I remember going to these focus groups and everybody had said, you know, Always Slender is completely on track. This is a perfect project for a brand new brand assistant. You know, we've tested everything. This is going to be a huge success. And I remember sitting behind that one-way mirror for the first time, watching these young girls, one after the next, after the next. And the advertising for Always Slender for Teen had focused on, we've got a shorter, slimmer maxi, right? So it went shorter and slimmer. And watching these girls one by one saying, you know, when I've got my period at school, I want a surfboard in my panty, right? Like, I don't want anything shorter and slimmer down there. The fear of an accident is so great. So within a few weeks of being at P&G, I was you know, exposed to how messaging can be make or break a new initiative. And that was the beginning.
Was it messaging, though? Or it sounds like, in this case, the solution wasn't their problem.
The solution actually was fantastic, because the product had been designed to better fit teenage anatomy. So it was actually a better product for those girls. But because the messaging had been what had actually done to the pad, right? We've made the pad shorter and slimmer. That was making the young girls afraid, making them nervous, mm-hmm. when the product actually was a better fitting product and more comfortable pad. And so it needed, you know, it was within a month of being at P&G, I was fortunate enough to be able to be involved in a whole, you know, strategic effort around how are we going to make this successful.
So did they reposition the, mm-hmm. the brand? And then did you have a chance to go to a follow-up, a group?
Focus group. Yes, and night and day difference, right? you have to really understand the insights in a category when you're working in them. And when, you know, teenage girls, the thing that they fear most is having an accident.
Embarrassment.
Right? Embarrassment, leaks, an accident. So you can't take a teenage girl, you know, their words were very insightful, right? You know, I want a surfboard in my panty, right? Like, I'd put the biggest thing down there because I don't want any risk, right, that this thing is going to leak. So I think similarly, we had a very interesting experience when we were developing Butterfly, because on sizing and how we were going to size our product. Mm-hmm. And so at the beginning, we had, you know, four different sizes, I think small, medium, large, extra large, and we'd go into these trials. And no matter what physical size the women were, everybody wanted the largest size. Why? Because little bowel leaks, even though they're little, are a huge problem, right? Mm-hmm. So everyone wanted the maximum protection. It was that surfboard analogy all over again, right? I want this biggest thing, right? But yet that biggest size wasn't necessarily the best fit. And so if you look at Butterfly, the way our product is sized is we went with pant sizing, right? So our small product fits pant sizes 0 to 10, mm-hmm. and our large size fits pant sizes 12 and above. So we directed people more into what I call like hosiery sizing, mm-hmm. or, you know, we tried to get people by body size. That was the only way that we could get people, you know, petite or smaller women to not want to overbuy the wrong size.
I got to say it. I can't. So it turns out size matters in everything.
Yeah.
So I got to believe that your house must be really interesting. I know you have several kids.
Yeah.
And so are you guys just open about everything? You talk about everything out at the dinner table? It's like that whole...
We do.
You know.
I think, you know, it's... and the funniest story I have about that is, I think 6 months into founding the company, it was the spring, the spring of 2012, and I got a call from one of my daughter's friends, moms, and she said, you know, Kelly, I just need to ask you something about what you're working on, because, you know, the kids at school, you know, Charlotte's at school telling people that you've got this product, right? And it goes in people's bums, and, you know, I'm just trying to get, you know, get some perspective here, right? I said, well, yeah, I said, that is, yeah, that's exactly what I'm working on. And it was kind of funny, but I think it's...
Wow, now how many kids, you know, parents' product is being talked about at school in some illicit way?
I mean, yeah.
No, not my kids. You know, my kids not worrying about that.
So that was a funny call. But I think, you know, it's, I think that in the next couple of years, there's going to be, you know, there's going to be increasing awareness of just how large a problem it is. And I think simple things can make a difference. And I think if you look at our blog, for example, on our website, you know, we have thousands of shares of our articles and contents. And to me, it's not just the sharing, it's the commenting that people are putting back, right? Mm-hmm. It's thank you for this information. I had no idea. You know, we're providing real education and resources, helping people learn how to do a better Kegel, figuring out the difference between soluble fiber and insoluble fiber, right? It's really giving people accessible resources and tools to help manage their symptoms.
I mean, it's so important to be able to do that, even at the highest level. In a previous role, was at a company that was trying to make a project for severe constipation, of all things,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And we actually had a lot of trouble when we were in some interactions with the FDA where they weren't that. It didn't seem like everyone who we were interacting with at the agency was as comfortable as they could be with the topic. But what really struck me was, I mean, regulars, you know, they're trying their best mm-hmm. to balance a variety of different pressures, but there wasn't the patient advocacy, because it was, no one wanted to admit, wanted to own it, wanted to say that they had it. It was more almost like the people who were suffering were really almost forced to suffer in silence mm-hmm. because they weren't putting ribbons on their chest saying, hey, I haven't gone to the bathroom in a month. But that was really the situation mm-hmm. for some of these people. And so it was a very powerful example of how some people don't have a voice, and how not having a voice specifically impacted how, what drugs you could advance and what things you could mm-hmm. approve, because everything's a balance of benefit and risk. And from the FDA's perspective, they were getting so little pressure to push to approve things and to say, wait a minute, there's all this patient suffering, because the suffering was in silence. So to the extent that you're able to articulate these sort of needs, I can really appreciate how important that is for large segments of patients.
Mm-hmm. And I think now, that makes me think of a piece of research that Bill Whitehead, who's been in this area for over 20 years. He recently ran a piece of research at the UNC School of Medicine, and he was looking at screening. So do, you know, what percent of physicians are asking about accidental bowel leakage? And as you might imagine,
zero,
practically none. But he also looked at patients, right? And we know that only 1 in 3 people who have ABL speak up about it, but they want to be asked. Everybody wants to be asked. And so it's fascinating, because one of the pieces of research that I'm collaborating on with Dr. Brown on right now is a study that's measuring screening. So we're looking at screening practice for both bladder leakage and bowel leakage. And not surprisingly, you know, you'll find we'll see a lot of screening on bladder leakage and practically none on bowel. But patients want to be asked. And they want to be asked, I think, not just about this, but about other things, right? I can imagine in the women's health space, right? You know, vaginal dryness. And there's all kinds of issues that people could have better solutions if we had conversation.
It was interesting. Some of the issues that you're talking about are often brought up is one of the things that drug companies, for example, they often do. They do these awareness mm-hmm. campaigns. And then a lot of these ads wind up being made fun of. John Oliver, for example, on his recent mm-hmm. show, I think he led it off by having some ad for female incontinence, urinary incontinence, or stress mm-hmm. incontinence, and sort of more or less making fun of an ad that was highlighting that. But a lot of what you're saying really would seem to suggest that there is a really very, very positive social good that comes from some of these advertisements and helping people become aware to sort of depathologize what they have and make people feel more empowered and more comfortable talking about them.
Well, now, that to be fair, that ad was a woman walking around hand in hand with a bladder with a smiley face, so that was a little weird. So, you know, I think, you know, to your point earlier, Kelly, that you know, it's really about the message, right, and packaging mm-hmm. it correctly for the audience. Because I can't imagine, I look at that ad and I think, you know, I don't know a whole lot of bladders that walk and talk, so you know, it's pretty weird.
But in terms of trying to capture that, the broader concept is that some of the advertisement even, you know, the evilest of all evils, pharma advertising, it sounds like there may be a real role for it in terms of helping people give voice to a symptom they're experiencing.
Absolutely, right? I mean, I think that, and if you look at in the case of, you know, accidental bowel leakage, the NIH has been on this topic for many, many years now. I think credit goes to Adil Baruka at the Mayo Clinic, who published the first, you know, landmark study that showed 20% of women over the age of 40 experienced accidental bowel leakage, and 90% of the time it was little leaks. I think up until 2005, I think if you said, you know, fecal incontinence or bowel incontinence, I think the first association most people would have is a little old lady in a nursing home in diapers, right? And I think what that began to show is that there's a significant unmet public health need.
So one of the things I like about your company is the bias towards women first, men second in the product development, which is so unusual in healthcare. It's usually, you know, almost all products are developed for men and then they figure out how to turn around and sell them to women. So
I don't know if that's true.
Oh, it is true. It's absolutely true. The clinical trials, you know, universally excluded women for the longest time. It's a new thing to even consider the product in that vein. So I think about, you know, why that? You know, what is it about the women's market opportunity that you saw or that you like first? And then and now that you've also transitioned the product to appeal to men, how has that gone?
So I will tell you that from the beginning, ABL, you know, men and women experience little bowel leaks equally. So there's not higher prevalence in men or women. If you look at the literature, you know, while there's, you know, decimal point differences, it's statistically insignificant. We knew that there was an opportunity with men from the beginning. However, being small and with limited resources, we led with our women's product. You know, one of the memories I'll always have of founding this company is that the very first email that I received after we were in our lead market, our test market, you know, I have a public facing email that's kellyb@butterfly.com. The little inbox in parentheses, you know, the number one. I'm thinking, I was so excited to go open this first email. And it was from a man in the south of Florida. And it said, Kelly, dear Kelly, you have completely missed the point. Men have this too. And it was profound in that we had originally envisioned that our men's product would probably be 12 to 18, 24 months behind the women's product. But I realized in that moment and in the cascade of emails that followed with the same message that we needed to get a men's product in the market quickly.
And so can you call it Butterfly, or does it need to be called like Touchdown?
No, it's Butterfly. Totally Butterfly. You know, we did the research on that. We paneled our product. We worked with men. We were able, by the time we launched nationally with Walmart, to have our Butterfly for Men on Walmart.com. And so it's now, it just went national in Target at the end of last year. And in fact, this week we're launching nationally with CVS, and wow, they're launching with our full line. Women's and men's will be on the shelf at CVS starting now.
Wow. So when you have all these experiences and then you sort of hang around with some of these like young entrepreneurs here without the experience in consumer product, without just the depth of marketing experience that you have, do you ever wish you could just sort of shake them and these people who are sort of these young entrepreneurs who are planning to disrupt healthcare and sort of tell them one thing or see something that they're not quite doing right, that they don't sort of understand that the benefit of your experiences can bring to them, you know, these sort of technology entrepreneurs, because, you know, you seem to just have so much of a practical sense for, you know, how to impact people, how to reach people, what people really want. And it seems such a contrast between so much of this sort of technology-driven, here's an incredible technology solution, we're going to jam it into your problem. And here it's more like, you know, you're really trying to be very, you know, you're really so much more consumer-focused. Is there any sort of learnings that you have from your experiences?
No, I think the single greatest piece of advice I can give anybody is start with the unmet need. Really understand what's the unmet need from the consumer or patient perspective. What are you trying to solve? And I think if you can build a product, whether it's a product like ours or whether it's an app, right, that meets that need, you know, you never win. You never lose when you serve the consumer.
So one of my favorite entrepreneurial related quotes is from Dickens. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. I think it captures that spirit of being an entrepreneur so well. What's the piece of advice that you got, you know, that's taken you through the tough times? Because I know it hasn't been an exact straight line to perfection here. It's very complex doing what you've done. And it's amazing what's been accomplished in a short time. What is the best piece of advice you got to take you through those tough moments?
You know, I always go back to the emails and the letters that we get every single day from consumers. You know, when it takes me back to my roots at P&G, which is really, you know, when you serve the unmet need, you know, you win. And I think that when times get tough, you know, I'm constantly, I'm looking at our reviews all the time anyhow, but I think those are the places that I go back to. I think the other thing is that our company, from its inception, has been surrounded, I think, by some of the greatest mentors. And you yourself, Lisa, I think have extended yourself. I tell people the story of when I met you all the time.
We want
right?
to hear it.
This is great. This is great. So Wendy Hutton is a partner at Canaan who's been extremely supportive of our company and a fabulous mentor and someone who I enjoy working with every day. And I'll never forget when Wendy sent me up and she said, oh, I think you should go meet Lisa, see what she has to say about this. And I went to Lisa's office and we went through our, you know, 10 slide deck. And Lisa listened very patiently and she said, okay. She said, Kelly, she said, this is totally not anything we'd invest in us. It's consumer, it's marketing, it's all the things we talked about. But she said, I'm going to help you. And she took that deck and sat down with a pen and we went slide by slide. And Lisa said, you know, here's how you can fix this. Here's how you can fix that. I think I had at the time $2 million in capital associated with a manufacturing line. And you Lisa put a big X through the $2 million in capital. And she said, Kelly, you can put venture debt on that line. Don't put your precious venture dollars into capital equipment. So I think, you know, the story of Butterfly has just evolved like that over time. I mean, we have, you know, mentors and people that have far greater experience than I across every single aspect of our company. And I think we'll get there. It just takes time.
So why don't you tell people the website so they can find the product if they want it?
It is www.butterfly.com. So we have the Butterfly URL. And I'd encourage everybody, even if you're you don't have little bowel leaks, to take a look at our blog and read some of those articles. It really, little bowel leaks affect 30 million people chronically, and 20 million people have it sports-induced ABL.
And it's for all ages, from pediatric through adult?
So our product was really developed with the adult population in mind. It's interesting that you mentioned pediatrics, because we actually have a lot of parents calling us. We've had lots of interest in children, and I think that's something as a company that we need to look into.
Well, this has been really fascinating, and I remember I had you in the class that I teach over at Berkeley to talk about this product, and I remember watching the transition of the students from entirely embarrassed to totally fascinated during that, you know, hour and a half session. So I think this is...
That kind of describes my transition.
Yeah, right, I know.
Too, absolutely.
It was hard to get David here today, but yeah. He's totally engaged now. So it's really
Not
great
true.
To have you here, and thank you so much for your time today and what you're doing.
Thank you.